coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
It's election time, and we'll hear from the two candidates vying for the 28th district seat in the Wisconsin State Assembly.
Well, I know that hundreds of thousands were left unemployed due to the government shutdown of businesses. And I know my office received hundreds of calls and emails asking for help.
The other thing I feel strongly about is local control. The conditional use permit, I think, would allow a CAFO, like this hog factory farm, to come within 200 feet of somebody else's property.
Plus, our weekly roundup of regional news. Coming up next. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Today, we continue our debate series of candidates for seats in the Wisconsin Assembly on the ballot for the November 3rd election. Today, we'll speak with the two candidates for the 28th District, which includes Polk and Burnett counties and part of St. Croix County. They are the incumbent, Republican Gay Magnifici, who is finishing her first term, having been elected in 2019. She lives in the town of Dresser and grew up on a farm near Deronda. She's been a registered nurse for more than 35 years and describes herself on her website as a proud conservative with strong family values, small business owner, a pro-life woman, a longtime hunter, gun owner, leader, and fiscal conservative. Welcome to Simply Superior, Gay.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is the challenger, Democrat Kim Butler. She lives in Milltown Township, where she and her husband own a small internet business. The couple moved to Balsam Lake 19 years ago to raise their two children. Before that, she was a TV producer in the Twin Cities for PBS at Channel 2, the Discovery Channel, and local TV stations. According to her website, she was diagnosed with stage 3C breast cancer 11 years ago, which informs her stance on affordable health care for all, accessible health care for rural residents. Welcome to Simply Superior, Kim.
Thank you, Robin. I'm glad to be here.
Our first question is basically your opinion, specifically why you think you're the best person to represent the 28th District in the coming term. We'll start with Ms. Butler.
Okay, thank you. Well, I certainly never thought that I would be running for office. It was never on my radar, but as you mentioned, it was actually about 15 years ago that I was diagnosed with cancer. And I went through that whole experience, and it was one of the first reasons that I started thinking, something is not right here. As you mentioned, my husband and I own a small business, and therefore we buy our own health care. And when we moved from Minnesota to Wisconsin, we found our insurance rates almost doubled, and yet the amount of things that were covered was halved. They stopped covering prescription drugs and any asthma and allergy treatments and a host of other conditions. And this was before I had cancer. Fortunately, the Affordable Care Act came along, and that solved some of my problems. And I was lucky when I did have cancer that I had decent insurance. So unlike a lot of people, I didn't need to have a spaghetti fundraiser to cover medical costs. But when I was done with treatment, you know, we did have a lot of bills for other miscellaneous stuff, and I started looking around for other insurance because our rates went up, and I was denied coverage, and ended up in the high-risk pool, and that was one of the first times that my family of four had three different insurance policies, which I think is absurd. After I finished my cancer treatment, I really felt compelled to give back to the community. I had a lot of help from the people in my neighborhood and my kids' teachers during my treatment, and I wanted to start doing volunteer work. And during the various volunteer things that I did, I started as a cookie mom and ended up as a troop leader and then treasurer and then running the entire district program. Same thing happened in soccer. I started as a coach and then ended up as regional commissioner for my district for 6 years. And during that time, I kept meeting parents who were working full-time but couldn't afford basic things. Buying their daughter's Girl Scout sash was a hardship paying the $35 soccer fee was difficult for them, but they didn't want a scholarship. They wanted to be able to do it, but just in installments, which was fine. But I saw people working really hard and struggling. Then at the same time, Act 10 passed, and I realized that a lot of my kids' really awesome teachers were starting to leave the profession afterwards. These were award-winning teachers who had many years of teaching left in them, but felt not valued and weren't receiving the pay and benefits that someone of their professional stature should. And that was really sad and frustrating for me. So kind of those three reasons, healthcare issues, jobs that weren't family supporting, and finally education, really compelled me to run. I thought, okay, somebody has to do this, and it might as well be me. I am someone who loves to learn. I love learning about issues. I like hearing many sides of a story, and I'm not wed to sort of one outlook of something. If someone comes to me with a compelling argument, I'll certainly look at their position. And when I've talked to Republican voters, they often say, "Wow, you've got a good head on your shoulders." And I think that that would come from being someone who has voted in the past for Republicans and independents. And while, you know, I hold Democratic values very dear to my heart, I'm also looking at other things all the time. So I would call myself open-minded. Obviously, I'm a mom. My husband and I have a small business that started in our basement and now employs probably 20 people in Milltown. I'm also someone that is used to compromising and working across the aisle and working really hard, putting in the effort that it takes to learn about an issue and to do the work necessary. Right now I'm juggling multiple responsibilities on top of running for office as chair of my local Democratic Party and also as chair of the 7th Congressional District Democratic Party, as well as mom to a couple kids getting off to college during a pandemic and, you know, helping my husband as much as possible in his business. So I feel like I'm someone that is going to be both responsible, someone who does the, you know, work, listens to the science, tries to find out about issues, and then also responsive. So I feel that I would be someone that would spend a lot of time listening to the people in our district, having a lot of listening sessions, and being open to talking to constituents and working hard to represent everybody in this district, not just the folks who voted for me or the people who agree with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. Ms. Magnifici?
Well, I am running to improve health care also. Like you said, I was a pediatric nurse for over 35 years. My first job was in an NICU where I cared for babies that were so small, they weighed less than a pound. I worked pediatric oncology. I worked the emergency department. I worked the PEDS ICU, and also I did 10 years working with sedation and procedures. So I've seen a lot of problems with the health care, and the way I see it, the best way is through competition to keep prices down. And so I'm running to improve health care. I want to protect people's property rights, their liberties, and their freedoms. I've always been a conservative Republican. I want a small and more efficient government. I really want to reduce the tax burden on everyone. And I just feel like we need to support small businesses because I feel like they're the engines of our economy. And I was happy to vote for increased funding for youth apprenticeships and technical education grants. Our small business and large businesses need skilled workers, and I want Wisconsin to be open for business again.
Thank you. So let's move on to the first question, beginning with Ms. Butler. More than 500,000 residents have sought state unemployment benefits since the pandemic began. How do you think the legislature should be helping workers during the pandemic?
Well, unfortunately, our unemployment system is antiquated and not up to the task right now. For probably 10 years or more, it was well known within the legislature and in state government that the unemployment system needed to be upgraded, that the phone system wasn't up to par, that the computer system itself wasn't up to par. It runs on an old, I think, COBOL system, and it's certainly not the only state in the country that does that. But one of the problems with that is that you can only do one thing at a time on the computer system. So they can't input data and run the system at the same time, and they can't, when they're at night, they have to, you know, be inputting data, so they can't do other things. The legislature hasn't met since March or April, and so I think the first thing they could be doing is meeting and dealing with this problem and not just throwing blame at the governor for a system that he largely inherited. I think that they should be doing everything as possible to, you know, up the staffing as much as they can. I know that people from all across the state government were pulled in to help people. But the main thing I think they need to do is, you know, stop the bickering and the posturing and political infighting about this and try and work with the governor and work with each other to come up with a solution for this.
Okay. Ms. Magnifici, same question. How do you think the legislature should be helping workers during the pandemic?
Well, I know that hundreds of thousands were left unemployed due to the government shutdown of businesses, and I didn't really appreciate who got to stay open and who had to close. They kind of picked and chose who was essential. And I know my office received hundreds of calls and emails asking for help. I probably spent the last 4 or 5 months helping people find their way through that. And I know there's still a huge backlog of people that are waiting. But when we met in April, it was Act 185 was passed in April. And that allowed the governor to transfer employees to other departments, such as to Department of Workforce Development, to help with these claims. But it wasn't until July that the governor actually did this. And I'm hoping that this helps with getting the people that the help that they need to pay their bills. I wish that I wish there was some kind of plan in place before this shutdown of the businesses took place, so that it would have been, because it just seemed like he said he wasn't going to, and then all of a sudden he did, and so many people were just out of a job. I'm sure it's over. I don't care what kind of computer system you have with hundreds of thousands of people going on unemployment, it's bound to overwhelm any system that you would have. And I know there's still a lot of states that have this particular system. So I hope that they do try to improve that. I would go along with that.
Ms. Butler, any response to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way that the governor could predict what was going to happen and how cases were going to rise. What we were being told by the federal government in February and March was that, oh, this is nothing to worry about. And it really wasn't until March. I know that I had one of the last in-person meetings on March 12th, mm-hmm. that this suddenly happened, and the government in Wisconsin, including the governor, had to be very nimble to try and do this. And, you know, public health and public safety has to be paramount, you know, making sure that people's lives are safe first, and then, you know, working on making sure that they get unemployment, that aid is going to small businesses, and that, you know, extra unemployment is going to people as well. But this wasn't something that he really could have predicted was going to happen.
Gay response to that?
Well, I guess some of it is kind of predictable. I mean, if you shut down certain businesses, and then I didn't approve of him saying that it was okay for Menards and Walmart to stay open, and then you shut down all these other businesses. I just didn't approve of that. So there were just too many people out of work. I talked to so many people that were in jeopardy of actually losing their business. They had their mortgages and their retirement, everything tied to their business, and then to have it just shut down saying they were not essential. And I just think that every business is essential.
All right. For Ms. Butler, along the same lines, do you support Wisconsin's mask mandate as championed by Governor Evers? And would you support an extension of it if the public health crisis warrants it?
Yes, I do. I think Wisconsin today is listed as the fourth highest or fastest growing rate of COVID cases per 100,000 in population. And we are quarantining entire dorms of students at the UW system schools, and in-person classes are shutting down at our schools, and, you know, the rate is climbing here in the 28th District. Burnett County is one of the highest, fastest-growing counties in the nation, and the load continues to grow in Polk and St. Croix counties as well as the neighboring counties. So I think that all of that is happening basically because the mandate has not been enforced uniformly. And if we look at science and we look at other countries who have had mask mandates and strict usage of masks, those countries are getting back to normal. They are reopening. You know, people are in restaurants again, kids are going back to school, and that's not happening in the United States because people were so against wearing masks. I've been someone that's been wearing one since March, whether or not I'm supposed to wear one, because, you know, decades of science have proven this. We do business in Asia, and we're used to seeing people in Taiwan always wearing masks on public transit. They learned in, I think, you know, the SARS or swine flu outbreak that that's just what you do to protect public health. So, you know, I don't like wearing a mask. I have asthma. I have breathing issues. But I wear it because I know that that's the single biggest thing I can do to help keep everybody safe and get the rates going down. I have a student at UW-Madison, and she, you know, didn't feel safe in the dorms and ended up moving off campus. And we're seeing, you know, what's happening because of that. Now all the dining halls are closed and, you know, kids are stuck in certain dorms and all in-person classes are off. Most of the classes were virtual to begin with. But we have a problem here in Wisconsin and it's increasing. So I think the last thing we need to do is stop wearing masks at this point.
Okay. Ms. Magnifici?
I do not support it. First of all, let me just say I really care about the health and safety of everyone, but wearing a mask should be a choice, not a mandate. I think you should respect everyone's personal space and practice good hygiene, which includes frequently washing your hands with soap and water or use hand sanitizer when that's not available. And try not to touch your face. I worked in the hospital, actually taking care of patients with all these other various viruses. And, you know, to protect myself, yes, I did wear a mask. But just to treat everybody like they have it or that they're asymptomatic is kind of unreal. I just feel like it's not the government's job to protect my health. That's my job and my responsibility. I think it's the government's job to protect my constitutional rights. As far as the mask mandate goes, I was just really disappointed that the governor, his lack of collaboration with the legislature before issuing it. And I believe our local governments, our businesses and citizens have already done a great job to appropriately and safely respond to the virus. I just don't think a statewide approach is the best for the interests in Polk and Burnett County.
Okay. All right, so let's move on to yet another issue sort of tangential to the pandemic. As many as 82,000 kids in Wisconsin lacked access to high-speed internet when schools shifted to remote learning in the early days of the pandemic. Governor Evers has created a task force on broadband internet. What do you think the state needs to do to make sure everyone is wired, particularly in rural areas?
Well, again, we are looking at 10 years of neglect from the legislature under Republican control when they simply were not spending what was needed to bring our rural broadband up to speed. during, I'd say the last 10 years or something, Minnesota has spent 8 to 10 times as much on expanding rural broadband in Minnesota as Wisconsin has. And the money that we did spend was going to really low-hanging fruit, easy jobs. One of the ones that bugged me was money going to Dane County. Now, I understand and I've seen the rural areas in Dane County, but Dane County also contains Madison, which is a huge tax driver. There's, you know, a lot of money, a lot of budget in Madison, and that goes to, some of that goes to the county. Whereas in, say, Polk County, we have no population centers like that, and we need assistance in getting rural broadband. So I think that we really need to look at a model like the rural electrification program in the 1930s or the Tennessee Valley Water Authority, where we do either a huge public government program to do this or a private-public partnership. But internet is becoming like a utility, and it's not just for school kids. It's also for small businesses. It's also for telehealth and for people who don't feel safe leaving their homes to have medical and also mental health appointments. So it's, you know, becoming something that's really an essential thing. I've talked to people in our area who have huge problems in conducting their business with the kind of broadband that they have. They have to wake up at 1:30 in the morning to upload complicated photographs and diagrams to their clients because their broadband speed is throttled. I have people around here who can't participate in our meetings because they have bad internet and they can't do Zoom calls. So it's definitely something we have to do. I was up in cable briefly and didn't have internet, and also at the time did not have unlimited data on my phone. So I was literally camped out at the library up in cable on their back patio doing work, doing Zoom conferences. When it was raining, I was sitting in my car, and it occurred to me, you know, it's one thing for me to be doing this as an adult, and it's another thing to be a third grader at 6 o'clock at night sitting in mommy's car wishing that she could go home but having to sit there parked in front of the library or McDonald's doing their homework because there's free internet there. So I think it's essential, and it's not going to get done. It hasn't been getting done, and the state needs to really up its game for it to get rural Wisconsin the kind of quality broadband that it needs.
Okay. And Ms. Magnifici, what do you think the state needs to do to make sure everyone is wired, particularly in rural areas?
Well, I agree with Kim. I do support increased funding for broadband. I know there are large areas of our district where it's a real problem, and I have talked to farmers around the area that do a lot online, and they pretty much have to wait till a certain time of day to do their business. And especially now with the kids having to do a lot of homework online, it's just a real necessity. And I have met with different broadband providers and had some great conversations with them, and I definitely would support increased funding for broadband because that is the essential anymore.
Well, since you both agree, I won't ask for a rebuttal on that, and I'm going to take the liberty to make a joke that I wouldn't have said otherwise, which is that Kim said she couldn't find broadband in cable.
That's a good one.
All right. You're listening to a special edition of Simply Superior, featuring a debate between the two candidates for the Wisconsin State Assembly seat for the 28th District, incumbent Gay Magnifici, a Republican from Dresser, and her challenger, Kim Butler, a Democrat from Milltown Township. I'm Robin Washington. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. And once again, it's member time at WPR. You rely on us for local election news like today's program, as well as our music, breaking news, and conversation. Your contributions make it all possible. To make one, give us a call at 888-202-2552 or donate online at WPR.org. And we continue now with our debate of candidates for the 28th District seat in the Wisconsin State Assembly. They are Gay Magnifici, the incumbent Republican from Dresser. Welcome back, Gay.
Thank you.
And her challenger, Kim Butler, a Democrat from Milltown Township. Welcome back, Kim.
Thanks, Robin.
So let's resume. This time, Ms. Magnifici will go first. You authored a bill that would allow someone with a concealed carry license to possess a firearm in a place of worship. What motivated you to write that, and what do you hope the intended result will be?
I just believe if you have a concealed and carry license that you should be able to. It had to do with if it was okay with the church or wherever. I mean, if they said absolutely no firearms, then you would have to respect that. But I think you should be able to protect yourself no matter where you're at.
Okay. Ms. Butler, what do you think?
Well, I think with so many pressing issues facing Wisconsin, that bill was really rather a waste of time, since many churches would, you know, state that they don't want guns on the premises to begin with. And so I don't necessarily understand the motivation of the bill. Yes. You know, people with concealed carry should be able to carry their guns, but most churches are going to say that they are banning guns on the premises. So there didn't seem to be a real purpose to it.
Well, along the same lines, Governor Evers pushed bills last year, or in the last year, that would seek to expand gun control, including background checks for private gun sales and a red flag law that would allow law enforcement to revoke someone's gun ownership rights if they're determined to be a threat to themselves or others. Gay Magnifici, do you support or oppose such measures?
I do not support the red flag law. That just has to do with due process of law. So you're already saying somebody's guilty before they can prove that they're innocent. I mean, anybody could, you know, call and say, hey, so-and-so is a threat to themselves or to others, and then they could send the law enforcement over there to take their guns away when they haven't even had any court appearance or anything like that. I think we have enough laws already on the books. I mean, just look at Chicago. Look at all the gun laws they have, and every weekend, every day, there's just multiple killings, shootings. So I don't know. I don't think that's going to help at all. I really don't.
Okay. Kim Butler, what do you think of Governor Evers' bills?
Well, all of those things that he proposed have shown to be very popular in polls across the country. Most people think that they are very good ideas to help improve safety. And most Americans feel like we need to do something, and this is a start. I have faith in our law enforcement professionals and our judicial system that they are not going to be out there randomly taking away people's guns, that there is going to have to be very strong proof that a person is a danger to themselves or others before anybody's guns are going to be removed under a red flag law. But from what I've read, many police departments do agree with this as well. Closing the gun show loophole is something else that, you know, definitely I agree with. I support law-abiding gun owners. And most people who are law-abiding gun owners don't mind going through, you know, background checks and things like that. I mean, I have to show my license to get my sinus medication. I know background checks are definitely more complicated than that. But if you have nothing to hide, you should not worry about having to do one of those. And the point is that we're just too many children are being shot at school and killed at school and in mass shootings at movie theaters and nightclubs and wherever, and we have to try doing something. And that's what the governor is attempting to do, is to respect people's rights to own guns, but to say, you know, we got to step it up a little, and we have to try to do a few things to make it more safe. Chicago is frequently used as an example. You know, they're right across the border from Indiana, which, to my knowledge, has extremely lax gun laws. So it's, you know, really kind of pointless to say that Chicago's gun laws don't work because, you know, they're next to a state that has no gun laws. So until we have more uniform laws, we're going to have problems like that. And I, you know, I won't go into the many other reasons like poverty and lack of education and things like that that are also contributing to the gun violence in Chicago.
Moving along. Just this week, a business group led by Wisconsin Dairy Organizations wrote to the Polk County Board of Supervisors taking issue with an ordinance that regulates and would extend a moratorium on swine CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations. They suggested the ordinance was unlawful and said it would harm the local farmers and likely lead to costly and reputation-damaging litigation for which the farmers themselves would be among those footing the bill. What's your view on this? Is there a balance you can strike between large-scale CAFOs and the environment?
First of all, I want to protect the environment, the water, the land, and the air. But as far as these CAFOs go, I mean, the DNR has strict regulations on how to, when you're starting up one, there are so many things that you have to go through. And I know the permits are really hard to get. And there's, I think they're renewed every 5 years and they can be modified. I know a good friend of mine, well, there's two friends of mine, they have dairy CAFOs here in the district. And if you go visit them, they are just really clean and they take care of the land. They have to answer to the DNR. So, and I did see that as far as the Polk County Board, as far as that letter that got sent from BATCAP. So we'll see what happens with that. But it's just, I just really think we have so many regulations now, and hopefully the farmers and DNR and everyone can work together to protect our land and water.
Kim Butler, your view on it.
Well, I don't have any issue with family-owned and operated CAFOs. As Gay says, they are heavily regulated by DATCAP and by the DNR. And the CAFOs that we have in Polk County are good stewards of the land. These are people who have been farming for generations, and they have become CAFOs, you know, largely because several generations of the family are farming, and in order to make that work financially, they've had to expand. But this whole issue started because an out-of-state company wanted to bring 26,000 hogs into Burnett County to the north and then Polk County. And we are a fragile ecosystem with the St. Croix River Valley here and with hundreds and hundreds of lakes. In addition to that, the tourism input into Polk County alone is something like 95,000 or 95 million rather of dollars that come to this county for tourism pursuits, and that is because of our beautiful lakes and our trails and our public lands and our outdoor areas and, you know, the beautiful and pristine St. Croix wild and scenic riverway. So to put any of that in danger so that an out-of-state company can come in and raise hogs largely for China, not even for the American market, just doesn't make sense to me. The other thing I feel strongly about is local control. People should be able to decide what's going to happen in their community. And some of the things, the conditional use permit, I think, would allow a CAFO, like this hog factory farm, to come to somebody's, within 200 feet of somebody else's property. 200 feet is not enough to stop the smell and the flies and, you know, the potential pathogens and things like that. This allows for protection without stopping, you know, family farms. Nobody wants to make life any harder for our dairy farmers here in Wisconsin.
Okay. Well, we're getting to a close. I'd like to give each of you an opportunity to ask your opponent a question. preferably something we haven't already discussed. So we'll start with Ms. Butler again. What would you like to ask Ms. Magnifici?
I would like to ask Gay if she is planning on upping her number of appearances and town halls and listening sessions in the next session, because she really hasn't had many in the past 2 years.
Okay.
Well, I held 5 listening sessions last year. I attended all the fairs for St. Croix, Polk, Burnett. I went to many of the fire department fundraisers. I attended VFW and American Legion events. I toured 6 nursing homes. I toured multiple mental health facilities, schools. I did Eagle Scout Courts of Honor. I toured many manufacturing businesses, Memorial Day services. I went to drug court. I'm a big supporter of Endeavor's Adult Developmental Center. I went to broadband companies. I went to high school tech programs, open houses. I went to electric co-op companies. I went to solar farms. I went to the SESTA number 11, all their meetings. I did Rotary. So I think I've put myself out there as much as possible. This year it's been a little bit of a challenge.
All right. I don't know if there can be a rebuttal to that, but is there one, Kim?
Yeah, I mean, I commend Gay for getting out there in the community and going to events. That's definitely part of a legislator's job. But I also think that it's important to have things that aren't social events or aren't closed sessions where people feel like they can come and talk about or ask about whatever it is that's concerning to them. And that's not going to happen at an Eagle Scout banquet. That happens at town halls, and that's what legislators do, is mm-hmm. have people come to, you know, the library or, you know, some town hall and just bring up whatever it is that's concerning them. That doesn't happen at that same level at a social event or at a closed, you know, private business or you know, a visit somewhere.
Response to the response?
Well, you know, like I said, I did 5 last year, which is more than most do. And we do talk about controversial things at these other different events, you know, because a lot of times they're in need of money for different things, for all kinds of different issues. So.
Okay. And your turn, Ms. Magnifici. What would you like to ask Kim Butler?
About the schools. How do you feel the schools are doing as far as being open 5 days a week with face-to-face instruction? And how do you feel about school choice?
Well, I think the schools are between a rock and a hard place. And no matter what they do, not everybody is going to be happy. Being open for face-to-face instruction worries teachers who are concerned about bringing COVID back to their families, to, you know, elderly people that might be living in their home. And on the other hand, it gets down to a child care issue. A lot of parents simply don't have, in addition to not having broadband at home, they themselves are not working at home, so they don't have supervision for their student, and they don't have someone to work with their child and help them navigate this. And that's causing a lot of parents to, you know, really feel like they must have in-person instruction. But I know that the schools are trying really hard. We're seeing some positive cases and people being sent, students and or teachers being sent into 14-day quarantine. So I think that we're really at a watching and waiting stage right here. This district has not had a huge spread compared to other parts of the state, but the rate that the numbers are going up is concerning. And I know that our schools are watching those numbers go up, and you know, doing whatever they can with separation and sanitizing and things like that to try and maintain in-person instruction, because it is particularly important in this area where a lot of parents are not working jobs that they work at home. They're not doing Zoom conferences all day, and their homes do not have the level of broadband that is necessary to have, say, multiple kids on different computers at the same time. You know, I know when my son came home from college in the spring to finish his final quarter, we had to increase our broadband because he and I were constantly fighting over space. So I'm just crossing my fingers and trusting the professionals at our schools to do the best they can, but I know that they may have to turn on a dime and move to a different plan.
All right. Rebuttal, Ms. Magnifici?
No, I was just very happy to hear that the schools were going to be open with face-to-face instruction for 5 days a week. And I think, you know, each district is different, and I know they all have plans in place should their situation change. And I know that there's many parents from around the district that are in support of this. I know the shutdown this spring hurt so many rural and low-income families. And also, I worry about the kids with the special needs, because I think they're the ones that really need to be in school. And I, as far as school choice goes, I think every parent should have a choice as to where they send their kid, whether it's open enrollment or a parochial school or homeschooling, whatever works for their child is what I want.
All right. Kim Butler, rebuttal to the rebuttal? Or?
Well, I certainly agree with Gay's point about children with special needs. And I've been thinking myself, is there some way to do something different with those students to, you know, somehow ensure that they get in-person education if maybe perhaps the rest of the school has to shut down? Because it's so essential to have a trained education professional working one-on-one or in small groups with kids with special needs. And they have been the ones that have really borne the brunt of this. Since Gay brought up school choice, I will say that we don't agree on that. I feel that public tax dollars should go to public schools, and that I really don't want public tax monies going to schools that are not accountable to taxpayers, that don't have to meet the same standards as public schools, and that essentially take money away from our public school system, which, you know, has really been the backbone of success in our nation, of getting everybody educated. And we have schools across Wisconsin that are struggling because so many of their public tax dollars are being siphoned off to smaller private schools that don't have to, can pick and choose who they educate. They don't have to take the kids with the special needs who are more expensive. They don't have to deal with the problem students. They can just say, nope, we don't want to have you. And they don't have to, you know, prove that they're educating children at the same level by dealing with the testing and meeting benchmarks and meeting guidelines for staffing. So I'm a big proponent of public tax money going to public schools. And I'm someone who did open enroll both my kids into a separate school district. And, you know, I appreciate that I had that option. And back when they were tiny and in preschool, I also sent them to a private school in St. Croix Falls, and they got a excellent preschool education there, which I paid for. But as someone who attended private schools at times, I also know there's a lot of scholarship money available. And I've heard people say with their parish school that they would prefer to fundraise to give more scholarships than to take government money.
Gay, rebuttal to the rebuttal?
Well, I know that the parochial school in Somerset I have a friend that her daughter goes to school there, and I mean, their property tax money that would go to the Somerset School District, it doesn't, you know, so it still goes to that school district, but yet they have to pay for their child to go someplace else. So they're getting the tax dollars, they're just not getting the money from the state, but the property tax dollars do go to fund that public school.
And that concludes this debate of candidates for the 28th district seat in the Wisconsin State Assembly. We'd like to thank the incumbent, Republican Gay Magnifici of Dresser. Thank you, Gay.
Thank you.
And the challenger, Democrat Kim Butler of Milltown Township. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you, Gay.
Thanks, Kim.
And we'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and once again, it's member drive time at WPR. You rely on us for local election news like today's program, as well as our music, breaking news, and conversation. Your contributions make it all possible. To make one, give us a call at 888-202-2552 or donate online at WPR.org. And we continue now with Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So a little more about those CAFO operations that our candidates just spoke of in the debate. Danny, we had some news in Polk County just this week, correct?
Yeah, the Polk County Board got a warning letter from business and farm groups who said that the action that the county was taking amounted to misconduct in public office, so they could face criminal charges under state law. Environmental groups came back and condemned that letter, calling it intimidation. And basically, it all revolves around a pair of resolutions that the county board weighed this week. One would have extended a moratorium on swine CAFOs in the county, and the other dealt with an amended land use ordinance that will require large-scale hog farms to get a conditional use permit. Basically, these groups say that the ordinance and the moratorium are unlawful and that they just want the county board to follow the law. Environmental groups say that, you know, they're just trying to bully the county. And the State Department of Agriculture has said that there does look to be, like there's some issues with this ordinance that the county board has put forth, because it does look like a couple of items within it do violate state law. So a little bit of a back and forth there. The county basically says that they're just trying to do what they can to protect citizens, you know, if a big operation moves into the county.
Right. And by big operation, we mean, do I remember correctly, it would be 26,000 pigs and sows?
Yeah, the reason that Polk County is doing this is because of a proposal in Burnett County that could have as many as 26,000 hogs. It wouldn't be that many right away, but over time, they're looking to possibly expand to that many.
Mm-hmm. And one thing, although I understand, well, certainly the business and the farming groups have their rights to write a letter and say whatever they want to say, they don't have any enforcement power, right? So if they say the county has broken the law, it's up to some other body to enforce that.
Right. They wouldn't be able to press criminal charges themselves. Basically, the biggest threat right now to the county is a lawsuit or a legal challenge saying that the provisions of this ordinance violate state law.
Right. And that gets back into the civil arena. So maybe more civilly on the election front, on the Minnesota side, the candidates are appearing, Brooks, but they're not talking about pig farms or anything like that, right?
Well, probably not. Both former Vice President Joe Biden and President Donald Trump will be in northern Minnesota today, Friday. President Trump will be in Bemidji looking to lock in his support. He saw in the 8th Congressional District, he won a lot of voters who had backed Obama in 2012 and 2008, while Biden in Duluth will be at a union training center looking to woo back those voters.
All right. Well, I said they're not necessarily arguing about hogs, but they are talking about economic issues and, as you pointed out, particularly labor votes.
Absolutely. They'll be making a very strong economic case, I suspect, in looking at who can do the best to help the area recover as mines come back to work following a pandemic shutdown and as a fight continues over the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline, which has certainly divided the traditional L in DFL, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party.
All right. Well, continuing on our business streak, Essentia has a major expansion, but maybe not so fast.
Yes. Well, it will be the tallest building in Duluth when it's done, and it will now not be finished until 2023. The Essentia Health Vision Northland campus that they're building in downtown Duluth is also now costing $100 million more than they originally planned. It will be a $900 million project, the largest investment, private investment in the city's history, and it will see a hospital tower rising 15 stories above First Street. It'll actually straddle First Street and move on up the hill, the first building of that kind in the city.
Well, a little bit smaller and not quite as tall, I believe. There was a house in Wisconsin that was owned by some Minnesota people that had a little water problem. Danny?
Yeah, Mike and Kathy Briggs, a Minnesota couple, and they have their dream cabin that's in Port Wing. They bought more than 20 years ago on the south shore of Lake Superior. And over the recent years, there's been a lot of erosion due to high water on the Great Lakes, and they estimate that they've been losing about 75 feet of their lawn each year. And so they were forced to sell that cabin last year for $1 and their garage, $1 each. And another couple moved it down the road. Otherwise, if they hadn't done that, it would have fallen into the lake this spring. They moved it last fall, and since then they've still continued to see erosion, like many shoreline communities across the Great Lakes. You know, a lot of them right now are armoring their shorelines with rocks or riprap to try and prevent their beaches from eroding away or their clay banks from eroding away.
Well, those are considerations to keep in mind when you're buying lakefront property or indeed maybe when you're building a high-rise hospital. We've been joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And we've also been joined by my colleague, Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Simply Superior.